Thanks, Emiko. It's nice to see those of you that I can see, and if it's at all possible, I would love to see more of you. It's really one of the special things about this sangha in particular is just the feeling that arises when we look at each other and we see that we're here. Which I'll say wasn't always the case. You know, when I started going to Spirit Rock in the early 2000s, it was a very white sangha, and noticeably and oppressively so. I often say that I was the only person of color at many, many retreats other than the Buddha. So anyway, it brings me great joy to be here with you all. And so our agenda for today, we're going to spend a little bit of time in meditation. I'm going to say some words about the meditation before we start. I'm going to share some Dharma reflections, and then we'll have a chance for discussion, questions, answers, etc. So I wanted to start by just sharing a teaching that comes from the Buddha. It's in the Satipatthana Sutta. This is the Buddha's seminal discourse on mindfulness. It's a teaching I really love because it's like a meditation instruction manual. And I'm one of those people that likes to read the manual. I've learned that, you know, when you don't read the manual and you're building an IKEA bookshelf, then you end up with like extra parts and extra pieces, or it's upside down. So here's an example where the Buddha has given very systematic meditation instructions. And I'll share four of them with you. So the Buddha is describing how to meditate. You know, he says, come to the base of a tree or an empty hut. So that's wherever we are in our living room, and arouse mindfulness. That we come into presence, we connect with this moment, we move out of the conventional mode of thinking and pondering and planning into just what's happening right now. And then the qualities of the Buddha encourages are a sense of diligence. This is really what I want to talk about mostly today, that we practice diligently. It means we don't give up. We don't succumb to the seduction of our fantasies and our chattering thoughts. And more importantly, there's this like a commitment, a vow, a determination to begin again. Because we know the mind will wander, but to begin again, and maybe even like a sense of beginning again, there's a kind of like a devotional quality to that beginning again. So this is what I'm going to encourage in our meditation, and I'm going to talk about in the Dharma reflection. So we can be diligent and then clearly knowing. So, you know, we're just going to practice with the breath today. So what it is, it is it to just know the breath, the felt sense of the body breathing, mindful, and then free from desire and discontent. And I love that this is in the instructions. This is the way to meditate. It sounds kind of, like, I don't know, wishful thinking that we just sit and close our eyes and we're free from desires and discontent. It doesn't usually work that way. But it's an important instruction because it reminds us that the way we practice should reflect the fruits that we want out of our practice. The way we practice should reflect the fruits that we're seeking. So if we're practicing in a way where we're clamping down on the mind, or we're straining, or we're struggling, or we're efforting in some way, then that's really what we're cultivating, is that sense of strain and effort. And so an invitation to relax, to connect with whatever ease and well-being is already there. This is one of the things about Buddhist practices, that we start with things that we kind of know, and then we universalize them. So with that, just inviting you to connect with some part of the body where there's a sense of ease, and close the eyes or soften the gaze and just seeing if there's any part of the body, however small, that's where there's relaxed, where it's relaxed, or a pleasant sensation. Or maybe even just a part of the body that's kind of neutral, there's no problem. Or maybe there's a pleasant emotion, can connect with that manifestation in the body. Just for a few moments, just to brighten the mind and nourish our being. And then letting the attention rest in the body. Noticing any part of the body where there's some sense of tension or holding, tightness. And then inhaling fully. And on the exhale, inviting the body to soften. Each exhale breath, inviting the body to soften, to settle. To fully arrive. Sensing into the groundedness of the body, the places where the body is supported by earth. It'd be the ground, or it might be the earth element through your seat. Maybe a sense of yielding to gravity, letting go of any extra effort, sinking fully into your seat. And then letting the attention rest on the feeling of the breath moving through the body. Feeling the inhale and the exhale of the body breathing with the sense that everything else fades into the background. We'll have to push anything away, just directing our attention on the felt sense of body breathing. Letting the practice be just really simple, breathing in, knowing, feeling, sensing the in-breath. And breathing out, knowing, sensing, feeling the out-breath. It's a gentle, relaxed effort. Every time the mind wanders, just beginning again, connecting with this visceral, felt sense of breathing body. You can sense the breath wherever it's most accessible. Maybe the expansion and contraction of the belly. Maybe the rise and fall of the chest. Maybe air at the nose or the upper lip. For most people, focusing on the breath higher in the body increases energy and alertness. Focusing on the breath lower in the body promotes relaxation. Breathing in, aware of the in-breath. Breathing out, aware of the out-breath. Everything else in the background, not engaging with anything but the breath. And every time you notice that the attention has wandered, just beginning again. And it's just beginning again and again and again. Builds our capacity for mindfulness. Receiving the flow of sensation in this breathing body. Just continuing to practice with this attitude of nowhere to go, and nothing to get or get rid of, no one you have to be, just this breath. I'm going to focus on the knowing of the breath. I'm breathing in, aware of the in breath. Breathing out, aware of the out breath. Just that. Letting go of anything that feels like a technique or a doing. And just resting. Awareness continues to notice experience, but there can be a sense of not picking anything up, getting involved in anything, and just resting. It's a quote from Alan Watts. We could say meditation doesn't have a reason or doesn't have a purpose. In this respect, it's unlike almost all things we do, except perhaps making music and dancing. When we make music, we don't do it in order to reach a certain point, such as the end of the composition. If that were the purpose of music, then the fastest players would be the best. Also, when we are dancing, we're not aiming to arrive at a particular place in the floor, as in a journey. When we dance, the journey itself is the point, as when we play music, the playing itself is the point. And exactly the same thing is true in meditation. Meditation is the discovery that the point of life is always arrived at in the immediate moment. Can use the sound of the bell to bring your attention outward. So, I'm pretty involved in a community called the Sacred Mountain Sangha, and in that, the training program that's ongoing. Actually, Emiko and I are in this training program together, called the Dharmapala, the Guardians of the Dharma, and it's an exploration of the Mahayana, the sort of the later teaching, the later stream of Buddhism that came some hundreds of years after the time of the Buddha. And one thing that is really emphasized in the Zen tradition, to some degree in the Tibetan tradition, is the idea of taking a vow. This is kind of central to central to this way of thinking, that the power of a vow, a determination, a sort of firm commitment to some principle or ideal. And usually the vows are vast in scope. One of the vows that you might take if you went to a Zen community is something like, and often, like if you go to Green Gulch Farms in Northern California, this is, chanted every day. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. What I love about these vows is that by the very way they're written, they're impossible. Beings are numberless. If they're numberless, then even if I could save them, it would be impossible to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. So the taking of the vow is not in achieving the vow. So this is already we're in a different orientation than we are when we sort of make New Year's resolutions, for example. Which mostly we tend not to keep, but there's some idea or some fantasy or maybe you do keep them, and then it's like a the joy of those kinds of things is often in the achievement of the goal. This is very different. It's not an achievable goal, so it takes us out of the results orientation into the process orientation. So what does it mean to take a vow? And to take a vow daily is sort of like the acknowledgement that we have to keep remembering. It's this concept of diligence, as the Buddha spoke of, have to keep beginning again in each moment. And when there's a flavor of devotion, of love, sort of like all these. Especially when we talk about compassion, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. That impulse, that inclination comes from a place of love. So you take vows in a loving way. It's transforming our inner landscape. It's just like how are we gonna approach any problem is sort of like through the lens of these vows. In the early Buddhist teachings, they call this an adhitthana. It's like a determination, a kind of promise. Almost seems like too not right, not the right word, because it's we might not keep it in the sense of a promise, but it's becomes the overarching paradigm. And we almost say that you keep taking this sort of vow or determination that it changes the brain. Like that these commitments pop up in the mind when they're often needed. And practice, is spoken of as a path, but it's a winding road with many crossroads, many decision points. And the vow acts as a kind of compass to help us discern, like, which direction do I want to go? How do I want to use this time that I have on the planet? And when we're paralyzed and we don't know which way to go, then the vow can be a kind of like, I always say, like, can we at least be facing in the direction that we want to go? So vows can be quite epic in scope, talking about saving all beings, or they can be more mundane. And that's what I wanted to really talk to you about, is like a very mundane kind of vow that I've taken. So I've taken the vow to pop the bubble of thought whenever I can. And I like to call it a bubble because often when we examine our thoughts, it becomes very clear if you go on a meditation retreat and you spend some amount of time really kind of shedding the superficial anxieties of the world and the way in which many of us are quite in a field of anxiousness, that an examined thought kind of pops like a bubble. It kind of loses its steam. It kind of evaporates. And when we can bring this commitment, this ongoing intention and determination to pop the bulb of thinking, it becomes easier and easier to do. And I like the idea of thought as a bubble because it's like we're in it. We're caught in our thinking, usually obsessed by it, entranced by it. And in the same way we talk about, like, I live in Santa Monica, California. It's, we might call it a progressive bubble. So everything in my environment reflects a kind of narrow worldview. A worldview I happen to love, but it is a narrow worldview, that thoughts are like this. Thoughts have beliefs and paradigms that may or may not actually correspond to the world, a whole set of facts that might be correlated to the real world, or might be, are all alternative facts that we've cherry-picked to support our worldview. It's like a bubble because it envelops our whole worldview, our mood, our sense of motivation. Like everything we experience in life is colored by our thoughts. And they're usually careening out of control in all directions. The Buddha had a word for this. He called it papancha. There's not a really good translation, but you might something like proliferation, diffuse, spreading out, complication, elaboration, distortion, colloquially. Colloquially seems like a weird word all of a sudden. In casual parlance, we might say monkey mind. So it's the mind that, before one thought is even completed, we've reached for the next one, like a monkey swings from vine to vine. I think we all know what this is, but I like to share a little video that this is the comedian Wanda Sykes, and she kind of makes this point in a very relatable way.
Think, can't stop thinking. Ladies, have you ever remember the time when you had a moment of silence in your head? Doesn't happen, does it? No. Always thinking. Sometimes you can't even sleep because you won't shut the hell up. You in the bed and your mind is just racing about nothing. Just, I need to talk to her tomorrow because I ain't like the way she spoke to me today. And I'm not going to have this uncomfortable thing going on between us. Did I lock the door? I should have bought those shoes. Where's my high school yearbook? What you gonna have for lunch tomorrow? I don't know. Why you think about lunch? You need to have a good breakfast. That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna start every morning with a good breakfast. Maybe I'll start that low carb diet. That seems to be working for a lot of people. What was my third grade English teacher's name? What was her name? Miss Jones, Miss Jenkins. Ooh, it's late. I need to be asleep. What the hell am I doing up? I don't know. Let me think about it.
Are other people hearing Gulu? No, Gulu, for some reason your sound cut out. We can't hear you. No. No.
Can you hear me now?
There we go.
Okay. So I think we can all relate to this mind that won't stop. And one of the ways I've heard meditation described is developing the skill of knowing where to rest the mind, where to rest the heart. How do we, where is it most skillful to give our attention in any particular moment, and having the meditative skill to be able to do it. So this meditative skill is popping the bubble of thinking. The Buddha likened this to an ox being enamored by its tail, this sort of quality of looping thinking. It's like being obsessed in a movie. Maybe you have this experience, a movie or some TV show, and you're so in it, you sort of lost connection with what's that it's a movie even. You're like leaning in, or when the protagonist gets startled, you get startled, or if there's some suspenseful thing happening, the body is tensing in a way as if you're just in it. And then the phone rings, someone in the room says something, there's someone at the door, and that instantly, that sense of being in the movie evaporates. Just like when we bring a moment of mindfulness to the thinking that's happening, it pops that bubble. The mind might not immediately shut down, and I'm going to talk about strategies, probably my favorite teaching of the Buddha, strategies for dealing with the monkey mind or distracting thoughts. But our perspective is changed when we pop that bubble, to realize that the mind is busy. That moment at the end of Wanda's comedy psych, where she says, why am I doing, I'm up. It's the middle of the night and I'm up and I'm just playing this game of thinking. That was like a little moment of mindfulness. And then of course she said, let me think about it, which is the joke, because that's where we kind of we that's our habit. We just go back to this endless loop of the ox chasing its tail. So if we're going to take a vow to pop the bubble of thought, it's helpful to reflect on the causes of this. And the Buddha spoke about this. He outlined a kind of process that leads to papancha, this proliferation of thought. What does he say? He says it starts with sense contact. This is a little bit like a technical way that Buddhist thought talks about experience. So we have these sense organs. We have the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, mouth. The mind is a sense organ. Thoughts appear in the mind, like sounds appear at the ear. So the sense makes contact with an object. We see something, we feel something, we hear something, we taste something, we smell something, or there's an arising of a thought. And you can almost say that there's a co-arising or an immediately after arising of what the Buddha called Vedana. It's this very simple valence of pleasant or unpleasant or neither. It's not yet to the point of liking, not liking, judging, labeling. It's just a kind of, it's the most subtle kind of sensory experience that connects with a sense concept. And then there's a perception, recognition. I hold something up, and without thinking, this is a cell phone. Drawing on memory, drawing on words, concepts, and then this point is kind of where thinking, as soon as I hold this up, you see cell phone, then you have lots of thoughts about cell phones. Or why is he holding up a cell phone? I'm trying to get away from my cell phone. Or, whatever thought comes to happen. And the conditions that support thinking are very related to this valence of pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. And something very unpleasant is happening in our experience. We'll tend to think about it. We'll go into problem-solving mode. Maybe we want to figure out why is this happening. Or we might have laments. This is happening to me again. Whatever it is. When something is very pleasant, that leads to more thinking because we think, oh, this is great. I love this. I gotta figure out how to do this all the time and make this keep happening. Sometimes we get, oh, this is gonna be over soon. When things are in the middle, when things are kind of like not that pleasant, not that unpleasant, I think our modern minds go to boring as kind of a interpretation of that. Nothing's really happening. Nothing's captivating my interest and attention and motivating me to act in some way. This is actually the place of equanimity, you might say. Like this band around neutral, not that pleasant, not that unpleasant, is a very, very fruitful place to rest our attention because there's nothing to worry about. There's nothing to obsess over. There's nothing to crave or cling to. There's nothing to be aversive towards. So, this craving and aversion, we tend to crave the pleasant, we tend to be averse to the unpleasant, is a source of this kind of uncontrolled thinking. Another source that the Buddha talked about was when we're obsessed with our views. And I see this happening anytime there's a political conversation or a conversation about if you're in social justice circles, people, beautiful hearts doing beautiful things and a lot of views. So it leads to that, and to also make a distinction between reflection and contemplation, trying to find your way through a problem where there's a sense of it's not racing, it's not outside our control. It's a kind of like directed thinking that's very fruitful. We talk about contemplating a problem or pondering our views to come up with like what is our moral framework or how do we want to go through this life. It's nothing. Those are all fruitful things. The litmus for me is this happening with agency or is this happening because my mind has a mind of itself? And if it's happening because the mind is untrained, then that's the encouragement to train the mind. Another source of energy for Papancha is when there's uncertainty and we're obsessed with this uncertainty. The anxiety we feel when the outcome of something is important to us and we don't know what that outcome is leads to all kinds of thinking. What if this? What if that? I don't know. How am I gonna, that kind of thinking. Which is why meditation often talk about, can we be comfortable in the not knowing? That there is no certainty. Actually, certainty is an illusion. We don't know. Like in the next minute, everything could change dramatically. So we can even like that's a bubble we pop of like thinking that there's some certainty and to rest in the discomfort of, yeah, I really don't know. And the trust that whatever emerges, there'll be some agency to meet that moment. Another source of proliferating thoughts is when we're obsessed with becoming. The Buddha called bhava, like who are we trying to be? And there's a way in which this is so positive, like yeah, figure out who you want to be and become that person. But it's like again, it's this grasping for some achievement, for some status, or even be like wanting to be a better meditator, wanting to be a better Dharma practitioner. When it has that energy of like obsession, then it leads to a lot of thinking. And then the last one he talks about is obsession with conceit. And conceit in Buddhism is just comparing. Same as, better than, worse than, same as. That's any kind of, like we don't even, we if we don't even get involved in the activity of comparing, we free ourselves from all the thoughts we have to have about comparing and how they're related. I compare myself to someone else and I find myself lacking, so that leads to becoming. And then, I don't know, can I become? There's uncertainty, and then maybe have a worldview that says, I'm no good, I'm not good at that thing. So all these things kind of work together. And then there's the craving for that. I want to be as good as, or I want to be better than. All these things kind of work together and overlap in a way of promoting a lot of thinking. And I think it's useful to know because we can then kind of like see the territories from which this arises. A lot of what the Buddha teaches is understand the causes and conditions that lead to well-being. Understand the causes and conditions that lead to suffering. I'd say the mind is out of control as a form of suffering. And then deconstruct those conditions and causes. There's a little passage somebody wrote. It's called Thinkers Anonymous. It started out innocently enough. I began to think at parties, just a little now and then to loosen up. Inevitably, though, one thought led to another, and I was more than just a social thinker. I began to think alone, to relax, I told myself, but even back then I knew it wasn't true. Thinking became more and more important to me, and eventually I was thinking all the time. I would get up in the morning and start thinking before breakfast, and I would think right up until I passed out at night. There's some humor in this, but it's also like the seriousness of thinking as an addiction. Like it's a pervasive force in our life that we can learn to be more and more free of, or more and more in control of, or more, or even more and more aware of. That's where it all starts. So we take a vow to pop the bubble of thinking. One of the easiest ways to work with this is to pay close attention to the feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And then see how the mind responds. See how the mind goes into aversion, into rejection. And cherishing, actually, if you can, that moment where it's not pleasant, it's not unpleasant, it's just happening. It's just like the moment is like this. And it can be peaceful. It's usually that's the moment I reach for my phone because the mind is so also addicted to stimulation. But can we rest in the moment of there's no problem here? This experience is unfolding. So my favorite teaching from the Buddha, I have so many favorites. I think I said my Satipatthana was my favorite. This is also my favorite. And it's called the Santanavitaka Sutta, the removal of distracting thoughts is usually the way it's described. And the Buddha gives a number of concrete, actionable strategies that you can use to pop the bubble of thinking. So the first one is replacing the thoughts. So you give attention to other thoughts. The analogy the Buddha uses, just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one. So too, a practitioner gives attention to some other sign connected with that which is wholesome. And then the mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. So I love the craftsmanship was highly revered at the time of the Buddha. And so this idea of that, like, just as a artisan develops the skill to knock out a peg, imagining a wooden peg that's holding something together, and so you knock out the peg with a finer peg, we can develop a kind of meditative skill to have more agency over our thoughts. If you have a metta practice, this is wonderful. I remember I was once at I was in a hospital waiting room. My father was having surgery, not life-threatening, but anxiety-producing nonetheless, and I noticed this feeling of uncertainty. And because this is what I've been practicing, I said, I know what to do with uncertainty. And I substituted all the what-if thoughts with, may he be happy, may he be safe, may he be well, may he recover quickly. Just keeping my mind focused on these wholesome thoughts. And it kind of over time, if you have a, again, a, if you're diligent about this and commit, after a few minutes, after 10 minutes, 15 minutes, the energy of anxiety dampens. The anxiety that's fueling those other thoughts dampens. So if you have a mantra, many of us got mantras at some point in our meditation practice, just resting with the mantra. If you've used the mantra a lot over time, there's a kind of entrainment that happens with the mantra. Like I have a mantra, when I say that mantra, it takes me into a mode more quickly because that's how I've practiced with it. Giving attention to other thoughts can be reframing. Gratitude practice is really helpful for reframing. There's a thought experiment that comes from the Stoics. They say that just anytime there's some suffering, you might reflect that your life, exactly how it is, with all the problems that you might have, all the difficulties and challenges you must face, is for someone else, this is the dream life. There's someone in the world who would give up everything to have your life. And that can kind of brighten the mind and change the perspective. when the form of papancha is a lot of beliefs, a lot of attachment to views, sometimes I'll drop in the question, is it so? Just to kind of like, so you can introduce some doubt into the certainty of whatever view I'm, fixated on. And then from Thich Nhat Hanh, notice what's not wrong. He talks about the joy of the non-toothache. We take a joy in like all the things that aren't going wrong. Yeah. Jon Kabat-Zinn says, if you're just that you're alive, however you are, means that so many more things are going right than are going wrong. Because just for this physiological process of aliveness, so many things have to work. Countless, limitless, mysterious things have to be working. So substitute the thought. Pop the bubble of thoughts. The second recommendation the Buddha gave is reflect on the effect of such thoughts. Which my translation is feel the suffering in them. Just to know the experience of where does this line of thinking lead me? And if you can connect with that in the body, feeling of tightness or the feeling of collapse or whatever it is. The Buddha uses a very colorful, shocking, powerful analogy for this. He says, just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human were hung around his or her neck. So it's like he's analogizing, your thought is going down a thought train. Like you could just think of it like, take the necklace off. You're wearing a necklace that's the carcass of an animal or human being. It's terrible, but it's within your control. You just take it off. It's kind of a sense of, we all get this. Like we know where this road leads. Can we just not go down that road again? We just take a beat and pause. I'll share. I think I could probably find it. There's a little, it's called the hole in the sidewalk. Maybe some of you know it. I think it's a nice way of thinking about this. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm hopeless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. And then the last chapter, I walk down another street. And I love this because practice is like this. Like we have to keep, we often will make the same mistake over and over and over again because it's a habit. But eventually we grok the situation and we find a better way. The third recommendation for the Buddha for removal of distracting thoughts, ignore them. He says, just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away. Letting them be in the background, not engaging or feeding with them. And there's a kind of thing that, the proliferating thoughts have an energy that's unpleasant. They create or coexist with anxiety or restlessness or worry, discomfort in the body. So they have this unpleasant vedana, this unpleasant feeling tone. And the compulsion with unpleasant is we want it to go away. We want to get rid of it. But I like, if you've ever sat with me, I love the analogy of the snow globe. I use it all the time. And if the snow globe is activated, there's no technique to manipulate the snow globe to allow the snow to settle. So any effort to make the monkey mind thoughts go away is just creating more agitation in the system. The way we let them go is by creating conditions which they would settle, which namely is coming into stillness. This is some of what we do in our meditation practice. We just come into stillness, body's more or less still, not taking in new stimulation and information, and then things can settle down naturally. So this capacity to just ignore them, to not get involved with thinking, requires that we've developed some capacity, some endurance, some diligence to bear with the fact that it's really unpleasant. Like the thinking is often a strategy associated with unpleasant, like we can figure our way out of this unpleasant situation. So ignore them, you know, and then it becomes like keep ignoring them because the seductiveness of thinking will suck you back in. And then that's what I'm talking about, that vow. Every time I notice that I'm caught in the bubble of thought, I'm gonna just pop it. I'm gonna keep popping those bubbles so I can be aware of thoughts without being like dominated by thoughts. The fourth one the Buddha gives, give attention to the stilling of thoughts. And the analogy he uses is a person is running through the forest. And then all of a sudden they realize they're running and they say, why am I running? I could be walking. And then they're walking and why am I walking? I could be standing. Why am I standing? What if I sit? Eventually they're lying down. Just kind of substituting for each posture one that's more subtle. And I notice this in my own experience where sometimes I'm engaged in some activity and there's way more energy than is needed for that activity. In my mind, it's like a picture of like I'm having a conversation with somebody and I'm making a point, but like metaphorically, it's like I'm waving my arms or really like there's like a lot of energy that's completely unnecessary. And sometimes when I can just bring attention to, oh, there's a lot of extra energy in here and just invite a kind of downshifting into less and less energy, just to soften, just to like to actually slow down, to pause, to take a breath, have a moment of silence. You know, when we teach meditation retreats, we often will tell people that just to slow down physically, because people come from their daily lives and then they come to a place where there's really nothing to do, really nowhere to be, and they're rushing around. Gotta get to the dining room, so you're rushing down to the dining room. Gotta get to the hall, you know, rushing up the hill to get to the meditation hall so you can sit and do nothing for 45 minutes. We can notice that this habit appears in our daily life. The last one, last occasional resort, not to be overdone, very sparingly, stopping thoughts with energy. And the Buddha describes this also very graphically with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth. He beats down constraints and crushes mind with mind, crushing any just evil or unwholesome thoughts. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too. The linchpin of this strategy of stopping thoughts is it doesn't work if there's aversion in it. It doesn't work if it's an angry kind of energy because that energy of anger is agitating. It just creates more energy in the system. But you can think, you know, if you know dogs, the pack animals, so they will respond often better to stop. And they a tone of voice that's stop, sit, you know, that's firm. There's energy in it, but it's not an aversive energy, you know. Love the dog. We're just or child, you know. Stop. You know, child's about to cry, you know, run into the street. It's like some energy or determination in it. So I do this with myself. Like I have some mantras for myself where I'm just in this papancha world, and that I'll use, and it's like enough already. For there's a kind of like weariness in that one. It's like enough. Or sometimes I'll say, "Good, get it together." Just like be my little cheerleader or coach. So to review, popping the bubble of thinking, pay a lot of attention to Vedana and how the mind reacts to pleasant and unpleasant, what we get obsessed with, what we get obsessed with getting rid of, our views, where we're uncertain, the energy of becoming, the energy of comparing, all places where thinking gets seated. And actually, I feel like it's, I'm going to review the strategies again, but it feel like it's almost enough just to notice that I'm caught in thought. It's almost enough just to change the perspective of, it's like with the movie, like, okay, I'm watching a movie here. My thoughts are a movie. And I don't have to be all involved in it. I can be kind of like, okay, I'm watching a movie. Maybe there's some useful things in the movie. Maybe there's some not useful things in the movie. Definitely not to develop, and to like befriend it. Like our thinking is a capacity that is, it makes us who we are as humans. The ability to communicate, the ability to be creative, the ability to heal and bring people together. Like we need our thinking. It's just about developing agency over that thinking. And then the Buddha's strategies for working with thinking. Substituting the thoughts, finding a better script, metta practice, mantra, reframing. Second, reflect on the effects of such thoughts. Know where this road leads. Walk down a different road. Third, ignore them. Let them be in the background. Don't get involved. Okay, busy mind's here. Can I just lovingly accept that busy mind is here? Not getting involved in the conversation. Fourth, giving attention to the stilling of thoughts, shifting into a lower gear. If you can get less energy into the system overall. And then as a last occasional resort, using some energy. This is like the energy of determination. So it could be like a vow energy, remembering your vow to pop the bubble of thinking. I'm going to end with a set of vows that are very important to me, that are more like, talked about grand vows and then a more mundane vow of popping the bubble of thinking. More mundane, but has been so impactful for me when I can remember to do this. Here's a grander vow that comes from Shantideva, that these words have been very meaningful to me. May I be a protector to those without protection, a guide for those who journey, and a boat, a bridge, a passage for those desiring a further shore. May I be land for those requiring it, a lamp for those in darkness. May I be a home for the homeless, and a servant for the world. May the pain of every living creature be completely cleared away. May I be the doctor and the medicine, and may I be the nurse for all the sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. Just like space and the great elements, such as the earth, may I always support the life of all the boundless creatures. It's from Shantideva. So let's just take a minute to let all those words, so many words, so much thinking. My thinking being projected at you, to just let that settle and close the eyes if that's helpful. Reconnect with the sense of the body breathing. And then we have space if anyone has a comment, reflection, question, contemplation. Compliment or critique? Is just trying to get your voices into the space, however that doesn't matter how it is.
Hi, Gulu. Thank you for the teachings today.
Hi.
Appreciate you. I chatted you a bunch, but when you were sharing about the teaching around conceit and comparing, I was reflecting on racism and, like, in a dialogue with the white male, if I noticed that power differential, like, you're saying things in a context of having the privilege and the power. I'm having feelings of like shrinking and naming that shrinking, like which is my experience and my truth in this moment. Like, how do I not do the comparison and the conceit?
I mean, I think this is well, one, I'll say it's aspirational. All these things are aspirational, and they often conflict with the harsh reality of the situation that we're in. And so maybe, I think there can be more awareness when comparing mind is happening, but maybe the dynamics of the situation don't give you any agency in that moment. So then it's something to reflect and ponder upon after the fact. And to see if, like, we can notice, our mindfulness works both ways, right? Internally and externally. So we can notice the internally comparing mind, and then we can notice the externally, the other person's comparing mind. And this is what our practice calls on us to do, is to just keep noticing, to keep brushing up against the points of difficulty, the points of stress, the points of, for me, the most powerful thing about racism has been noticing how much of it is internalized or anticipatory. So that's where, like, I can develop introspection on, what role is my mind playing in this, having grown up in a white supremacist culture, I've internalized so many views that are in the frame of conceit, comparing, and illuminate, shedding light on those is profoundly supportive. What you do with other people, it's a work in progress. But to notice also, I've been in these situations, where I feel like there's a power differential, or I'm being put in a box or discriminated against or something. Oops, I didn't mean to send that to you. I'm sorry. Trying to chat, Emiko. So many. Yeah, I mean, it's almost too much to say on that topic. That just to say that for me, that like when I'm in the situation where I feel like that's happening, the awareness that it's happening is liberating, even if it doesn't liberate me topically or in terms of how I'm going to respond or act. To say, oh, I see what's happening here. And then I might have grief or pain around it that I, we'll work on in all the ways we do, talking to friends, therapy, meditative practice, other healing modalities. Like, we need all the tools we can to heal from systemic racism and all the isms. Yeah, and just to end, your other question is an important one. Is like, there's thinking where I'm gonna have a problem I want to solve, and I'm gonna sit down and I'm gonna think about it. think about pros and cons. Maybe I'm making a list. People can make flow charts or other kinds of ways of organizing our thinking in a creative way. Sometimes sitting with a question, like dropping a question into the mind stream, not trying to figure it out intellectually or problem-solvingly, but just to see what emerges from the depths of intuition or the depths of different kinds of knowing. I'd say that's all like thinking with agency. Having a conversation with someone to communicate appreciation or just to connect with them, the thinking that goes into that is, the Buddha would make the distinction between wholesome and unwholesome. Is this thinking leading to the benefit of myself and others or the detriment of myself and others? And so I'm contrasting that. When I say with agency, I'm contrasting that with the monkey mind that just won't stop and becomes a torment, actually. This is one of the most common torments that we have and that we often, if we're newer to practice, it's the first thing we notice. Like, the mind just will not shut up. And it's mostly garbage. That's what I liked about Wanda Sykes' thing. It's just like random things that just appear. And then often things will appear and we give them so much meaning, but it's just, they say that like thoughts appear in the mind like saliva appears in the mouth. It's just inexplicable. I've reached the end of my time, but I would like to say one last thing, which is that Spirit Rock counts on the support of the Sangha. Like, Spirit Rock does not belong to me as teacher, doesn't belong to Emiko as staff member. It's not, Chase, Mobile, Verizon, Spirit Rock. It could be like we could have all these like corporate sponsors, and probably be a lot easier in some ways if we had like a big billboard and that paid for everything. But it doesn't, and there are challenges that persist from the time of the pandemic that are really make me concerned about the health and longevity of Spirit Rock. So it's just an invitation, and maybe Emiko, you can share a donation link. It's just an invitation to, if you have capacity, to be generous, to share some of that generosity with Spirit Rock. And also other ways I'm sure Spirit Rock can be supported with through volunteerism and other kinds of things, which I'm sure you can find more on the website. Thank you everyone for your lovely attention and participation. It's always a joy to be here. I'm uplifted by your existence.